from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, despite the bomb at the UN compound, an advisor to the Pentagon says the United States needs only to stay the course in Iraq.
But is Iraq becoming a new breeding ground for terrorism?
There are many unhappy folks in Iraq who don't like the damage that was done to their country or the continuing occupation, and they're taking up arms to oppose it.
And a success story from Baghdad, cleaning the place up.
We did get the garbage picked up, and I have to say that was a real thrill to see the backlog cleared away.
Also, treating heroin addiction, a new approach in the U.S., and Canada tries giving addicts a safe place to use drugs.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is heading back to New York today. He cut short a vacation after yesterday's bombing of UN headquarters in Baghdad that killed 20 people, including a top UN envoy. During a stopover in Stockholm, Annan insisted the United Nations will not pull out of Iraq.
We will carry on the mandate that has been given to us by the Council. This afternoon, I will meet with the Council in New York for us to reassess the situation and talk about what has happened in Iraq. But the main message is that we will persevere, we will continue our work. It's an essential work, and we are not going to be intimidated.
The UN envoy to Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello, was among those killed in the bombing. The FBI is leading the bombing investigation. And NPR's Ivan Watson, who's in Baghdad, says U.S. authorities are reviewing security.
The de facto American governor of Iraq, Ambassador Paul Bremer, he said in an interview today on television that there is a review underway of the foreign embassies here in Baghdad, but warned that there is no such thing as 100% security from terrorism. He also pointed out that he believes there are more than 100 foreigners who are operating in this area, as well as a group called Ansar al-Islam, which the U.S. is saying is an al-Qaeda spin-off organization that is also active in the region.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. UN workers were told to stay home today while crews search the compound rubble for clues. Alabama's Chief Justice is turning to the U.S. Supreme Court for help in keeping a controversial Ten Commandments monument in the state Supreme Court. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports from Montgomery.
Chief Justice Roy Moore has filed an emergency request with the nation's highest court, asking for a stay of today's deadline for him to remove a 2.5-ton granite monument of the Ten Commandments from the Alabama Judicial Building. U.S. District Judge Myron Thompson and a federal appeals court have ruled the scriptural display unconstitutional. Thompson gave Moore until today to take down the monument, or the state faces fines of $5,000 a day. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has already denied two of Moore's last-minute attempts to stay today's deadline. Now all that remains is his appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Moore argues the federal judge does not have authority to make him remove the monument and has said he will not abide by the order. His supporters have vowed to kneel around the display to prevent it from being moved. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Montgomery.
Las Vegas residents are still cleaning up from yesterday's deluge. Forecasters say 3 inches of rain fell in 90 minutes. Some areas lost power and were flooded, while others got just a light drizzle of rain. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 16 points at 94.12. The Nasdaq is up 3 at 17.64. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, analysts are beginning to estimate the bill for the huge Northeast blackout. It's between $4 and $6 billion. Insurance advisory company Insurance Services Office says the blackout will not rate economically among the 10 worst disasters ever. The company says the most expensive disasters were the September 11th attacks and Hurricane Andrew of 1992. A gay employee at United Parcel Service has filed a lawsuit against the package delivery company. The suit accuses UPS of marital status discrimination. From Georgia Public Radio, Mike Savage reports.
47-year-old Daniel Klein works at an Oakland, California UPS office. After his partner relocated to Chicago, Klein asked the Atlanta-based company for a transfer, but says UPS turned down the request, despite a company policy that offers relocation for domestic partners. Klein's lawsuit alleges the company's transfer policy violates the Federal Employment and Housing Act's prohibition on marital status discrimination. Under state law, Klein and his partner cannot be legally married. However, the suit seeks damages and a court declaration that the UPS policy is illegal. UPS says it is still reviewing the lawsuit, but the company says Klein's transfer request was approved. UPS officials tried to contact Klein's attorney about the approval, but so far the company says it has been unsuccessful. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
The parent company of the second biggest tobacco firm in the nation is warning of job cuts. R.J. Reynolds Tobacco says these could start as early as next month. Last month, R.J. Reynolds says its sales dropped sharply from what they were a year ago. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
I'm Gail Harris in for Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As FBI agents combed the devastated UN compound in Iraq for clues as to what exactly happened and for bodies, a search for answers, too, in Washington. What now in Iraq? Send more soldiers, spend more money, or wait? Fight the guerrilla war Iraq's become, maybe for years to come, while slowly winning Iraqi hearts and minds. Well, to discuss what the Bush administration should do now, we're joined by Kenneth Edelman, a key member of the Defense Policy Board, which advises the Pentagon. Welcome, Mr. Edelman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Kenneth Edelman, if you're a planner in the Bush administration right now, what's the plan? How do you change the approach to occupying Iraq in the wake of the UN bombing, if at all?
I think that what you need to do is to find Saddam Hussein, stabilize the situation there as best you can, and then just start as much as you can with the replacement of Americans and UN officials with Iraqi officials.
Everyone would like to turn this over to more Iraqis, but is that possible in the short term? And if we continue to be attacked almost daily, nothing should change, no more soldiers, no more money. What do you do?
No, I think that there is a need of more money. I don't think there's a need of more soldiers. I think there's a need of overall more soldiers, but they should be Iraqi soldiers and not necessarily American soldiers.
Are you saying that essentially you stay the course and not change?
Absolutely. I would stay the course. These forces cannot defeat America. They can just injure America's will, and I don't see it happening with this administration, and frankly, I don't even see it happening with the American people. Listen, it took time after every war to get a country back on its feet.
So after a massive bomb at the UN compound, with the possibility that such a bomb could hit another soft target in Iraq at any time, you're essentially saying you don't change anything.
No, I'm not that. Now, listen carefully to what I'm saying. I'm saying that there should be a transfer of authority over the coming months to the Iraqi Governing Council and to more and more Iraqis.
Mr. Edelman, how are Iraqis going to change the possibility of an al-Qaeda truck bomb blowing up a soft target?
Well, in that case, they won't. But that is a danger of our age. That is something that we're going to have to live with across America. That is something we're going to have to live with in Boston. That's something we're going to have to live with in Iraq and Jordan and in Indonesia, whatever. That is why we have to fight terrorism with everything we have and not negotiate with terrorists, not, legitimize terrorism in any way, but to realize that we have to defeat the terrorists.
How do you defeat the terrorists?
Well, you just go after their leadership, as we have been doing. You go after their members, and you change the dynamics so that people like Saddam Hussein, who funded terrorism and who supported terrorism for 30 years, are out of business now. And I would love to see a change in government in Iran that has also been responsible for a lot of terrorism and start changing that. If we change the, we have changed the government of Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan, which are two big supporters of terrorism, and, you know, we just have to go at it.
We'll just finish with where we started. You don't expect the administration to change its tactics in the wake of this big, devastating bomb at the UN compound?
I don't believe so, but I'm not in the prediction business. I'm in the giving advice business, and my advice would be to stay the course, to realize that we live in an age of terrorism, and people are going to try to blow us up, whether in Boston or in Baghdad, and that is why we have to do everything we can to defeat terrorists wherever they are in the world.
Kenneth Edelman, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
You're welcome.
Ken Edelman is a member of the Defense Policy Board. For an extended version of this interview, go to our website, here-now.org.
New questions are being raised after yesterday's bombing in Baghdad about whether Iraq is rapidly becoming a breeding ground for terrorists. In the classic definition, a state that can't control its borders or provide for its citizens' basic needs. Paul Bremer, the U.S. chief administrator in Iraq, voiced those concerns this morning on NBC's Today Show.
After the war, it appears that a number of terrorists from the Ansar al-Islam group have re-infiltrated into Iraq. We are concerned about that. We also have other foreign terrorists who've been arriving from other borders.
Are U.S. forces in Iraq now facing a new alliance of religious and nationalist Arabs driven by a mutual hatred of the West? Organized forces whose efforts are fueled by public unhappiness? Joining us now from Monterey, California, is John Arquilla, a professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School. John, as we're hearing about a new jihad, who do you think is behind it?
Well, I think there's a mix of inside and outside actors. There are certainly some infiltrators trying to get back into Iraq, but that's no easy trick right now. I think what we're missing is the fact that there are many unhappy folks in Iraq who don't like the damage that was done to their country or the continuing occupation, and they're taking up arms to oppose it. We, for example, don't talk about the faith movement, which is something that exists in mosques around the country and is actively recruiting fighters against the occupation.
Well, what about the other side? I mean, where's Iraq's silent majority? Why aren't we hearing from them?
If indeed shock and awe worked at all, it shocked many into silence. They've had their country destroyed, an order they knew for a quarter of a century taken away, and a large occupying force put in their country. And I think it's sensible for most Iraqis to stand by on the sidelines to see what's going to happen. I think Kenneth Edelman was talking about reducing the American responsibility for affairs in Iraq, and a good way to do that is to raise the importance of the United Nations. I think this would also tamp down some of the sentiments of resistance to American occupation.
Well, and what about some of the concerns of these ordinary Iraqis? Is there anything that American forces can do to assure people that their daughters won't be raped or their sons kidnapped inside their homes or on the way to the grocery store?
Well, I think an orderly transition to a UN authority with blue helmet soldiers and a reconstituted Iraqi military would go a long way toward restoring order, and some American presence would probably be useful. But we need to realize that these sentiments in large part grow out of the amount of destruction that was done during our campaign. We dropped seven times as many bombs in this latest Gulf War as we did in the last one in 1991, and it's this level of destruction that caused so much suffering in the country, including the deaths of many thousands of innocent people, that has fostered a lot of this resentment. So I think if we're talking about what threats they perceive, they see great threats from us as well as from disorder within the country.
And so does that make the war a very effective recruitment tool, bringing forces together that might not otherwise be willing to do so under the theory that the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
I think we Americans have to be very careful about the exercise of force in this terror war, whether in Afghanistan or Iraq or in other theaters. Every time we start shooting, others are watching very closely, and so we must be careful to maintain the immunity of non-combatants. We call it collateral damage, which is a terrible term. But when thousands of innocents die, that's not warfare. And we have the ability, we have the technology to fight in far more efficient ways today in smaller and smarter groups. And I think if we do that, we will keep the mass publics of these various countries from resenting us too much.
John, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
John Arquilla is a professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California.
Well, despite so much recent bad, sad, and tragic news coming out of Iraq, it is worth noting that some reconstruction efforts are succeeding. Take, for example, one basic, garbage. Recently, Jenny Seymour worked as an interpreter for the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Baghdad, helping the Army Corps of Engineers clean up a city awash in trash. Jenny Seymour now joins us from her home in Alexandria, Virginia, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, Jenny, thank you. Now, how did you hear about this job? How did you end up helping the garbage get picked up in Baghdad?
Well, actually, I have academic training. I did my PhD in Middle East Studies, but I had my resume on a website called Translators Cafe. And one day a funny email came in mid-April, and it said, would you like to go to Baghdad? Please make up your mind in 24 hours. And I couldn't turn down the dare.
Paint me a picture of the streets from the perspective of the garbage in them.
Oh, it was terrible. Big mountains of garbage. Very few dumpsters or public receptacles exist in Baghdad. So with 3 weeks of no collection, you can just imagine the huge drifts of garbage up against buildings and on traffic medians, a horrible, horrible stench as the weather got hotter. And we were, in fact, very afraid that there could be an outbreak of cholera.
Now, what did your difficulties ultimately in getting garbage picked up tell you about the larger problem of trying to reconstruct Iraq? What was your greatest difficulty?
It was an unwieldy process, and their city government was nothing like ours. So we, you know, had to kind of work with them to devise an emergency system, working with contractors to lift this trash, even though at the time we didn't really trust the people we were working with. And as a form of bargaining, they would present us with invoices, and we'd say, no, these are wildly inflated. And they'd say, oh, okay, here's another invoice. And we'd sort of go back and forth like that. We had cordial, sometimes humorous relations with these guys, but it was a real headache for us.
You learned some lessons, though, about the larger question of reconstructing Iraq. How difficult do you think it's going to be to reconstruct so many things, from the water to the electricity to the oil?
Well, I think that, you know, for us, trash was a bit easier because we could make an immediate impact on that. Mm. With sewers and electricity, it's much more difficult. It's going to take a lasting investment. The challenges, I think, are similar, though, in the sense that you have to have good partners, reliable partners, and also there is an element of civic responsibility, which unfortunately doesn't thrive under a corrupt totalitarian regime. People aren't used to being able to make a difference.
Civic responsibility, an interesting thing to bring up. People raised in a situation where your number one priority was just to keep the bosses happy, your overlords in the government, so that you wouldn't get on the wrong side of them. How do you get people to a sense of civic responsibility coming out of a dictatorship?
Well, I think it's going to be two steps forward, one step back. People need to see some success in being able to impact their communities. They need to feel that they are going to have some form of representative government. And I'm very encouraged by the new neighborhood advisory council system. There are 90 elected neighborhood councils in Baghdad right now, which they never had in the past. And I hope that they will, you know, help people to have some faith in a system where they can make a difference.
You did ultimately, for all the problems with somewhat dishonest contractors and on and broken trucks, you did get the garbage picked up.
We did get the garbage picked up, and I have to say that was a real thrill to see the backlog cleared away. And we were lucky in the sense that we could make an impact in a short period of time. And people, we would always, you know, talk to the Iraqis who came into the palace. How's your neighborhood? How's your collection going? But the ongoing challenge will be to come up with a system that works for Baghdad.
Jenny Seymour, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You bet.
Jenny Seymour joined us from her home in Alexandria, Virginia. She was an interpreter for the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Baghdad from April to July of this year. Well, coming up, lessons for today from Cicero's Ancient Rome.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The man we're about to discuss was one of the first and most eloquent advocates of human rights, of ideas from which democracy flowered, a man revered by the founders of our own country. Still, he had his doubts about ordinary folk, the common people, and he was ruthless enough to have political opponents executed. His grand ideals and personal vindictiveness inspired his still legendary public oratory. He was noble, thin-skinned, of profound philosophical depth, an admitted physical coward, and he died one of history's most courageous deaths. He was Cicero. Historian Anthony Everett's written a book about Cicero that's just now out in paperback, a book subtitled The Life and Times of Rome's Greatest Politician. Anthony Everett now joins us from Essex, England, and welcome, Mr. Everett.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. Mr. Everett, Cicero was born in 109 B.C., killed in 27 B.C., a time of near constant civil war in Rome. He wasn't a military man, yet he was alternately courted and despised by the likes of Julius Caesar, Marcus Brutus, Pompey, Cato, Caesar Augustus, and Mark Antony. And I want to ask you first, why did Cicero matter so much to all these powerful men?
Because he was right in the middle of events. He was a brilliant speaker, a brilliant public speaker. If you wanted an orator, if you wanted a lawyer, you went to Cicero. There you have a man who we have nearly 1,000 letters, personal letters left. And so we, reading those letters, we can live through again these huge events. We can meet Julius Caesar. We can meet Mark Antony.
Cicero was present at the assassination of Julius Caesar, was he not?
He was, and he was sitting in the front row. It was almost as though it was a benefit performance. The conspirators didn't let him into the conspiracy because Cicero was so indiscreet. He loved a joke, do you know? You couldn't rely on him to keep a secret.
Uh-huh.
But actually, he stood for old values, and Marcus Brutus and the other conspirators, in a certain sense, did what they did for Cicero.
Mr. Everett, remind us, what was the Roman Republic, and why did it matter so much to Cicero?
Well, the Roman Republic was a strange place because you had a kind of a mixture, and it's a mixture that's rather similar to the United States. And if you look at the founding fathers in the 18th century of the United States, they loved Cicero. They read him.
Hmm.
Why? Because Cicero's idea was you don't want too much democracy. It doesn't work. You don't want too much monarchy. It doesn't work. You don't want too much aristocracy. What you need is a balance of all three.
And yet, why was it such a tumultuous time? It was a time of almost constant civil war when Cicero was alive, and ultimately, soon after he was killed, it was the end of the Republic when Caesar Augustus became emperor.
That's right. Well, that's a very interesting and very acute question. Cicero lived in a republic that was trying to run an empire, and it found it very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. How do you run an empire if you're a republic? It's easy enough if you have an emperor. It's easy enough if you have some kind of an autocrat, to have some kind of a Saddam Hussein. What went wrong with the Roman Republic was that it was actually fundamentally unable to govern the Roman Empire, and that was its great problem. Now, the reason why Cicero's life is so interesting is because it gives us one or two ideas about the world today, about the great superpower of today, trying to, on the one hand, be a democratic republic, and on the other hand, to manage the global community. And in a way, that was the challenge that faced ancient Rome 2,000 years ago.
And ultimately, Rome dropped the Republic and became a place where, for many hundreds of years afterward, partly to maintain its empire, turned to emperors.
That is the sinister conclusion of history.
Let's talk about...
I'm sure that's not going to happen with the American Republic. I have too much confidence in it. But there's always that risk.
Now, Cicero died horribly. His head and hands were severed and then put on public display. why was he killed, Mr. Everett, and recount for us how he confronted that death?
Well, after the murder of Julius Caesar, he stood for the old republic. New people came along. Julius Caesar's adopted son, an 18-year-old boy called Octavian, who later became the Emperor Augustus, Mark Antony. They wanted to move on. Cicero wanted to return to the good old days, and he fought the good fight. He very nearly won, but at a certain battle, he lost, and Mark Antony and Octavian, but especially Mark Antony, would not forgive him. So they ensured that he was assassinated. They couldn't put up with Cicero surviving. And for one time in his life, the physical coward stood up to destiny, and he died a great and noble death.
But you bring him to life in your new book, Cicero, The Life and Times of Rome's Greatest Politician. We've been speaking to Anthony Everett, the author of that book. And Mr. Everett, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Next week, we take a different approach to the fall of ancient Rome. We'll speak with author Michael Parenti, who says Julius Caesar may have been a very different man than history's made him out to be.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, singer Diana Darby's new CD. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, heroin addicts in one province in Canada will soon have a legal place to go shoot up.
And a new treatment for heroin abuse comes to the U.S., one that requires a prescription.
It has some properties similar to drugs like methadone, but it has some other properties that make it much more safe because the risk of overdose is greatly reduced.
And stuffed tomatoes with a bit of Provence thrown in for flavor.
Those stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Kofi Annan says yesterday's bombing of the UN mission in Iraq is not going to drive the UN out of that country. The attack killed 20 people and injured at least 100 others. Speaking to reporters in Stockholm, the UN Secretary General says those behind the bombing are not helping the people of Iraq.
Most Iraqi people would want to get on with their lives. They have suffered for far too long not to be given a chance to rebuild their lives and to pick up the pieces. And these extremists who are attacking innocent civilians are not doing their nation or the people of Iraq any service.
The U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, says yesterday's bombing shows the terrorists have regrouped in Iraq and that there's no such thing as 100% security from terrorism. Iraq's governing council has condemned yesterday's attack and declared 3 days of mourning. Council members believe the bombing was committed by members of Saddam Hussein's ousted regime with help from outside militants. West Virginia authorities say a string of deadly sniper-style shootings may not have been random. Kanawha County Sheriff's Deputy Phil Morris says it appears that at least two of the three victims were deliberately targeted in the attacks last week. Morris did not say what leads officials to that conclusion or whether there are any suspects. Tests show two of the victims were killed by the same weapon. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham is promising a thorough investigation of last week's blackout as he leaves for a meeting with his Canadian counterpart. Abraham tells the CBS Early Show investigators will meet with researchers and industry analysts to determine what caused the blackout and how it spread to such a large area.
There are fail-safes in the system that should have contained this and prevented it from becoming a massive outage.
And Abraham tells the CBS Early Show the international panel will identify what needs to be done to ensure that an outage of this size never happens again. Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the removal of a controversial monument to the Ten Commandments. He installed it in that state's judicial building 2 years ago. A federal appeals panel turned down Moore's request. Alabama's attorney general says he expects the monument will be removed by the end of the day. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 25 points, the Nasdaq up 2. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Canada is taking a new approach to its war on drugs. Now, last December, the Canadian House of Commons called for the usual remedies of tougher law enforcement, more treatment, but also, beginning this September, what will become North America's first chain of safe injection sites, where heroin addicts can go to safely, well, shoot up. inject themselves with clean needles under medical supervision. Joining us on the line to discuss this from British Columbia is Provincial Health Officer Dr. Perry Kendall. Welcome, Doctor.
Hi, Bill.
Dr. Perry, Canada for decades has been, for the most part, as tough as the United States on drug users. Why the change?
Well, Canada for at least 30 years has also had alternate recommendations for a more public health approach to dealing with substance abuse that focuses not only on reducing drug use and abuse, but also on reducing the public health and public safety harms that are associated with it. This implementation of this policy that was recommended by the government really follows about 5 years' worth of very high overdose deaths, very high HIV rates, very high hepatitis C rates in many of the cities, but particularly in the city of Vancouver.
Now, this is an experiment. What will determine whether it's policy across all of Canada eventually?
We will be looking at public health gains, which would include a reduction in overdose deaths, a stabilization or reduction in HIV and hepatitis C incidents, improved health and functioning, and reduction in emergency room admissions. We would also be looking at referrals to social and addiction support services, and we would be looking at its impact on public safety. We'd like to see a decrease in public injecting and a decrease in public drug use in Vancouver.
Something else being looked at in Canada, something called an experimental prescription. Can you tell me briefly what that is?
This is slightly different, but it's also a compendium of treatment, and it'll be a randomized clinical trial looking at the impact of adding heroin to methadone for injection drug users for whom the current best treatment has proven to be ineffective. And it follows the work that has been done in Switzerland, in the Netherlands, and in Germany to see whether the addition of heroin to methadone is an alternative approach, a sort of last-ditch approach to sort of rescue, if you like, refractory injection drug users who in many cities are actually responsible for the majority of crimes and drug dealing and drug acquisition, but for whom we do not have effective treatments.
Now, how's the public reacting to this? Vancouver's mayor, it seems, won office in large part by promising to introduce these reforms. Are you facing opposition?
There is some small and local opposition concerned that this would in fact act as a honeypot and bring more drug users into the area. This certainly hasn't proven to be a fact in any of the other cities that have tried this, to my knowledge, that's been reported.
Canada's also largely decriminalized marijuana. Is law enforcement just throwing up its hands at the drug problem?
No, absolutely not. I think that law enforcement is trying to do two things, recognize that addicts are people with health and social problems and that treating them as criminals is ineffective and not cost-effective. And by moving to sort of some judicial decriminalization and moving to some degree medicalize some of these problems and provide other solutions, that the finite and stretched resources of law enforcement can then go after better targets. For example, they can target the drug trade rather than the user.
Dr. Perry Kendall, thanks very much for joining us on this.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Perry Kendall is Provincial Health Officer in British Columbia, Canada.
In the U.S., federal drug treatment authorities are touring the country promoting another new alternative treatment for heroin addicts, the first since methadone. Buprenorphine became available in the U.S. last January after a decade of use in Europe. It's said to be safer than methadone and to cause a less dramatic withdrawal from the drug. Joining us on the line is Robert Lubrin. He's director of the Division of Pharmacologic Therapies at the U.S. Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. Hi, Robert, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Robert, this buprenorphine is being described in some quarters as the biggest advance in addiction treatment in decades. Is that how you see it?
Yes. For one thing, there have really been very few medications in the last 30 years in this field that have proven to be effective. And methadone, for example, which some would consider the gold standard of medical treatment for opiate addiction, was introduced over 30 years ago. And in the intervening years, there have really only been one or two medications with very little impact on the treatment field.
And do you think it will replace methadone one day, or is it simply a good alternative?
Well, we do not see it as a replacement. For one thing, pharmacologically, it has limitations, and there are some patients, particularly somebody who has a very high dependency on opiate drugs, who has a chronic condition with a need of a high dose of medication, may not do well at all on this treatment. Somebody who needs a lot of structure in terms of the counseling and other kinds of services.
Hmm. Something else that seems to be new here is that family physicians are being trained to administer this drug. Why is that something that hasn't really been done before?
We think that there is a lot of people who are going to their family doctors or primary care physicians who would be more willing to discuss their treatment with a family physician. There's a lot of denial. People don't want to admit that they have this problem. A lot of physicians don't want to admit that their patients have this problem. So we're hopeful that because that's where the primary care system is delivered in the States, that patients will be more open and the doctors will be more willing to ask questions about abuse.
How is buprenorphine administered to patients?
Buprenorphine is a sublingual tablet. That is to say, you would put it under your tongue and it would dissolve in 5 to 10 minutes, and the active parts of the product are then absorbed through the bloodstream.
What are the advantages and disadvantages? How would you be able to choose as a physician what was more appropriate for your patient who was a heroin addict?
Well, you can look at it both from the pharmacologic standpoint and the system standpoint. Methadone treatment, for instance, cannot be prescribed. It has to be given out on a daily basis at a federally approved program. So in many communities, there is no such program. People have to travel hours and hours a day in order to get this treatment. So automatically, because this treatment can be delivered by physicians, the possibility of expanding treatment in areas where it's not available is a real plus. In terms of the medication itself, it has some properties similar to drugs like methadone, but it has some other properties that make it much more safe because the risk of overdose is greatly reduced.
Hmm. Robert, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Robert Lubrin is director of the Division of Pharmacologic Therapies at the U.S. Center for Substance Abuse Treatment.
Still to come, resident chef Kathy Gunst on the art of stuffed tomatoes.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Today's the deadline for Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore to remove a monument to the Ten Commandments from the state's judicial building. It was Justice Moore who, overnight 2 years ago, installed the 2-ton granite sculpture in the building's rotunda. Federal courts have repeatedly ruled against him, but Judge Moore argues the Ten Commandments are the moral basis of American law, and he's asking the U.S. Supreme Court to step in. Well, joining us on the line from Montgomery, Alabama, is Rusty Thomas. Rusty's a preacher from Waco, Texas, and assistant director for Operation Rescue Operation Save America. Welcome, Rusty.
Thanks so much, Bill. God bless you.
Rusty, you've been taking part in a candlelight vigil on behalf of the monument. How hopeful are you the monument will stay where it is?
Well, I can tell you this is a very critical time for the history of our nation. And I have my hope in the Lord, but I do not have hope when it comes to our nation relating to God as the source of our justice system and as the very basis for our laws.
In other words, you think the monument's going to go?
Well, you know, the tyrant, Judge Myron Thompson, who decreed its removal, he's not foolish. I don't think he wants to push for a showdown. But I will tell you this, Bill, what's at stake here is the very principles that founded the United States of America. In other words, if there is no transcendent God, if there is no such thing as higher law, then the United States of America is a rogue nation in rebellion to a lawful authority, which is England. There is a separation of church and state, but it's not in our founding documents. It is in the Bible, and it's in the Word of God.
But, Rusty, the federal judge who ruled that the monument violates the Constitution, U.S. District Court Judge Myron Thompson, says it could be simply moved to a less public place, like Justice Moore's office. Why wouldn't you be satisfied with that? Why not just move it to another place?
Because you got to understand what the central issue is here. The central issue here is not Chief Justice Roy Moore, nor that monument. The central issue is, can the state acknowledge God? Now, in the state constitution of Alabama, it is written that the justice system of Alabama and the laws of Alabama find its source in Almighty God.
How would you feel if a judge at a courthouse in Alabama or anywhere else decided that there should be a large Quran, for example, in the well of the courthouse for everyone to see as they came in?
Well, I'll tell you this. If we abandon Christianity and the law of God as the source of God's blessing upon this nation, we are going to see Islam arise. But I'm going to tell you something, Bill. If they capture that sort of civil government, you will either convert to Islam or you will die.
Hmm. Rusty, what are you going to do about this monument in the courthouse today? If they try to take it away, what are you going to do?
Well, we're going to peaceably lay down our lives. In fact, I'm at the state capitol right now delivering 150,000 petitions to Governor Riley and to ask him to make a righteous stand and to stand with Chief Justice Roy Moore and do what is right.
Well, Rusty Thomas, it's been interesting to speak with you. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Well, it was a blessing, and thank you so much, Bill.
Rusty Thomas is a preacher from Waco, Texas. He's been part of a candlelight vigil in Montgomery, Alabama, to try to prevent the removal of a monument to the Ten Commandments.
Later this week, we'll speak with a legal scholar about the origins of American law. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
It's tomato season, and if you're now wondering what to do with all those fresh tomatoes ripening on the vine, well, Here and Now's resident chef and cookbook author Kathy Gunst is in the kitchen to cook up some of that summer bounty.
I like potato, you like tomato, I like tomato, potato, potato, tomato, tomato.
August for me means ripe tomatoes, dozens and dozens and dozens of ripe tomatoes. I have a ritual every year where I go into the garden, I pick the first ripe red tomato, and I bite into it just like it's an apple and let the juice drip all over me. I don't care. It's summer. It's a tomato. It's as fresh and delicious as food can possibly get. Although I am quite happy eating a tomato raw or sprinkling it with a little bit of salt and pepper and olive oil, I also love to make stuffed tomatoes. This is a dish I first learned visiting the southern part of France in Provence, where tomatoes are everywhere and they have them for quite a few months, and they've become very innovative with tomatoes. And this is an extremely simple way of taking a delicious fresh food and making a very elegant dish out of it without a lot of effort. This recipe is quite easy. You scoop out the tomato, you chop up some onions and garlic, and you cook them in some olive oil, lots of fresh herbs, little bit of breadcrumbs to bind it, and then the inside of the tomato gets added, and all of that gets stuffed right back into the tomato halves, and then it just bakes for about an hour. So you can do this in the morning and serve them at room temperature or warm. It's just the perfect dish for August, and then all you need to do is serve it with some good bread to sop up every bit of the juice. So we're going to get started by making the stuffing. We're going to start with garlic, fresh garlic. I'm going to take about 3 cloves and smash them with the side of my knife and peel them and chop them. What we're going to do is put a little bit of olive oil into a large skillet, and we're going to cook this chopped garlic with a chopped onion. Okay, I've got a large skillet. I'm going to add about a good heaping tablespoon of olive oil. Definitely want olive oil. This is a Mediterranean dish, and so we want the flavors of the Mediterranean, which are garlic and olive oil.
And you like potato.
You like tomato.
And you like tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Let's go.
Okay, 3 cloves of garlic. And about a tablespoon of olive oil and 1 medium-sized chopped onion. And I'm going to lower that heat a tiny bit because we want to let this cook a little bit slower. Let all the natural sweetness come out in that onion. Oh, it's so fresh, it's making me tear. Now I've got beautiful herbs from the garden. You can add virtually anything you like. I have basil here, thyme, parsley, and chives. We're going to add a very good handful. And what does that mean? It means you want to add a total of about 1 cup of herbs. You could add tarragon, rosemary, lemon thyme. Please don't add dry herbs. That would be an insult to these gorgeous summer tomatoes. I've got a beautifully ripe, not too ripe, you don't want them falling apart, but you want a really juicy ripe tomato, and you're going to cut it in half widthwise. And then what you're going to do is take a melon scooper, and very carefully you're going to scoop out the inside of the tomato so that the tomato skin is retained and it's a shell for the stuffing we're going to add later. So I'm going to scoop it out. I'm not going to go all the way down so that I go through the skin, and I'm doing this right over the skillet. You can hear it's catching the beautiful juices of the tomato. And I'm going to scoop it out, and I'm going to put it right into the pan and let it cook with our onion and garlic and herbs. We're going to do this with about 6 to 8 tomatoes. You can make this dish well ahead of time and serve it at room temperature or heat it up at the last minute.
You like tomato, and I like tomato.
Now I'm going to preheat the oven to 350 degrees. I have my tomatoes scooped out, so I have these beautiful tomato shells here. And I'm going to let the onions and the herbs and the tomatoes cook down a little bit so that all that tomato juice gets intensified in those onions. We'll add a little bit of salt and pepper to the stuffing. Now, this is a really special part of this recipe. I have my tomato shells in a roasting pan, and they're empty. They're just a shell of the tomato. And I'm going to take something called olive puree. It's also called tapenade, or sometimes you'll see it as olive pesto. And this is also another ingredient of the Mediterranean. It's become very easy to find these days, and it's a gorgeous black spread of olives that have been cooked down. And I'm going to take just about 1/2 teaspoon, and I'm going to spread it into the bottom of the tomato shells, so you have this red tomato shell with just a thin layer of this very pungent black olive spread in the bottom. So I'm taking a little bit here, and I'm just spreading it right into the tomato shell. And what that's going to do is be like a flavor base. The stuffing will sit right on top of it, but when the tomatoes bake, the black olives will flavor the whole tomato skin, and it is just fabulous. So I've got 16 tomato shells. I started with 8 tomatoes, and they're all spread with a little bit of the olive puree. My stuffing has cooked down. The tomato juices have thickened. The onions are soft and golden brown. The garlic is all soft. And I'm going to take it off the heat, and I'm going to add anywhere from about 1/2 cup to 1 full cup of breadcrumbs. If you have a hunk of leftover bread sitting around, make your own breadcrumbs by simply putting little chunks of it into a blender or a food processor and letting it whirl around until you get little fine breadcrumbs. You can also use commercially bought breadcrumbs. And you just want to add enough to keep all the tomatoes and onions, that whole stuffing, so it comes together. So we'll just add a little bit at first. That looks just perfect because all the herbs and juices are coming together. And now I'm going to add about 1 tablespoon of that olive puree just so that the olive flavor gets carried through. So our stuffing is garlic, onions, basil, thyme, parsley, tomatoes, and olive pesto. You can imagine right now that this place smells a little bit like a kitchen in southern France. It's absolutely all my favorite ingredients, and they just smell amazing. So my stuffing has cooled down a little bit, and I'm going to just take a spoon. And again, this is going to depend on the size of your tomatoes, but a good heaping tablespoon. I'm going to pack it right into the tomato there. Just mounding it with the back of your spoon so that it's just a really nice dome of stuffing sticking up out of the tomato. And I'm going to repeat that with all of the tomato halves, dividing the stuffing up, pushing it into the tomato half, and just pressing it down so that we get a good amount of stuffing in.
You like tomato, and I like tomato.
Okay, I've got all the tomatoes stuffed. My oven is at 350. I want to drizzle them with just a touch of olive oil just to keep them moist while they're roasting, and a little bit for the bottom of the pan so that the tomato skin doesn't touch. All right, I've got the tomatoes stuffed. They're drizzled with olive oil, 350-degree oven, middle shelf, and in about a half an hour, your whole kitchen is going to be filled with the essence of summer tomatoes. But after an hour, they'll be ready to eat. So we'll check back. It's been an hour since I put the stuffed tomatoes in. Oh, there they are. They've beautiful. They've softened. The shell of the tomato is nice and softened, but it hasn't collapsed at all. The tomato shell is strong enough to hold the stuffing, and the stuffing has turned a very beautiful golden brown, and that little bit of olive oil has kind of glazed it a little bit. So enjoy these tomatoes Provençal, and do not forget to get a really good loaf of crusty bread, because you want to sop up every single bit of juice that's at the bottom of the pan and the plate, because the olive oil with that tomato essence is something not to be missed.
You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst. For a recipe, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Minigon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
A survivor of the Chechen raid.
Stories, Here and Now.
A survivor of the Chechen raid.